speaking to African people, to indigenous people, you know, and all colonized peoples.
The uptick in hate against Asian Americans is reminiscent of the Japanese internment camps established during World War II by President Franklin Roosevelt. Fearing the influence of the Japanese war machine, the U.S. authorities rounded up about 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry.
Guarded by armed soldiers, many of these camps were still being constructed when incarcerees moved in. These hastily built prisons were overcrowded and unsanitary. People frequently fell ill and were unable to receive proper medical care. The War Relocation Authority relied on incarcerees to keep the camps running. Many worked in camp facilities or taught in poorly equipped classrooms, while others raised crops and animals. Some Japanese Americans rebelled, organizing labor strikes and even rioting.
The Japanese, many of whom were American citizens, were forced out of their homes and incarcerated in concentration camps shortly after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. A 1983 report revealed that the move resulted more from racism than from any actual security risk.
The systematic disruption of their lives came with many hidden details still unknown today, yet captured the apex of hate against Asians in America. Ms. Hess, can you tell us more about the history of violence against Asians in the U.S.?
The U.S. is attacking Asian people historically and today, in both in terms of war and violence, and in terms of economic attacks as well, and that we recognize that the U.S. dropped the bomb, the atomic bomb, on Hiroshima, Nagasaki, in Japan. They put Japanese people in concentration camps in this country during the Second World War, and that, you know, that this that attacks on Asian people are longstanding.
Asian Americans have been around since the U.S. Civil War of 1865, but have not been included in the discussions around race that much. There are around 20 million of them inside the country, and the question is, will they ever have equal rights? Deep-rooted open bigotry against Asians might have now gone underground, but it continues to exist.
Big news. Good news. And we plan to come down here to Georgia, to the place that made it possible, to share that information. And then Tuesday night, we learned that 8 of our neighbors were killed in a heinous act of violence.
Falling victim to racist rhetoric and xenophobia, the victims of the Atlanta tragedy were also women. Women, particularly women of color, also have their own plight in the United States. Asian Americans, therefore, are among the myriad marginalized communities demanding that their voice be heard. How did anti-Asian sentiments lead up to the situation we see today?
I think what we're seeing is a byproduct of Trumpism to a great extent. All of the talk about the China virus, was very toxic to the political environment. And it has so permeated society at all levels.
Today, many Asian Americans live in fear, but they're also bound to hit the streets and loudly demand their rights in a country that claims to be the leader of the free world. Decades after the Japanese internment camps, the outrage, sadness, and fear among Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders have only grown.
One of our black guys is bleeding unstoppably.
But the red eyes still cannot see anything right now.
Xiao Zhensheng's family took this picture of her at home tonight. A day after being attacked on Market Street, her daughter and grandson say the 76-year-old can't see out of her right eye.
She is still suffering some pretty serious trauma.
Good evening. In Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. I'm joined tonight by Rachel Hu from Breakthrough News. She's a journalist in New York City. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion on anti-Asian racism. And I want to start off by discussing public perceptions of the coronavirus. How have these played into what seems to be an epidemic of anti-Asian racism?
And I think that there are so many things to dive into when we talk about this epidemic of anti-Asian violence. I think it's twofold. You know, one element of it is the long historic reality of racism against Asian Americans in this country. We've been persecuted for hundreds of years. I mean, the whole creation of Chinatown to begin with as a concept started because of massacres of Chinese people in America during the 1800s. In fact, it happened so much, it was called the Tacoma Method, after Tacoma, Washington, where 500, you know, people in an angry mob burned, looted, and destroyed Chinese communities and forced them onto trains to leave. And so, you know, it became so widespread, and the mayor of Tacoma became celebrated as a national hero, that this really became what happened all across the West Coast, informing Chinatowns by driving out Chinese people through very serious and in really intense violence. So that's kind of one component of it, right? And then to bring us to the more modern aspect of it, it's really important that we contextualize the anti-Asian violence, not only just within coronavirus, but within the greater U.S. hegemony and really U.S. pivot towards Asia that began during the Obama era.
Rachel, what can you tell me about Donald Trump? Obviously, he popularized phrases like Kung Flu, the China virus, extremely racist ways to refer to COVID. What has his impact been in all of this?
But during the Trump administration, I mean, they really put forward China as the reason why COVID was just completely destroying our country, when in fact it was their actions. It was the actions of the U.S. government, or rather the inaction of the U.S. government, that killed 500,000 people in this country. We've had no economic relief. Other countries like Germany, I mean, other European countries, even in Singapore, they've given relief to people in their countries, and we have not seen the same type of support whatsoever. And so instead of taking responsibility for the butchering of this pandemic by the Trump administration, instead they place the blame on China as a way to divert attention from the failures of U.S. capitalism and the failures of the U.S. government, and instead put the blame solely on China, as if China was responsible for the fact that people in this country have not had stimulus checks on a regular basis to keep us afloat during a pandemic.
Wow, Rachel. Well, I think you are right. We're looking at an absolutely catastrophic mismanagement, mishandling of the coronavirus situation in the United States. So I think it's no wonder folks are looking to place the blame elsewhere. We want to thank you so much, Rachel, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for tuning in. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
With racism and inequality raging across America, it's no surprise to see that Asians are also suffering from repercussions of the deep-rooted issue. This is why many Asians residing in America are economically successful and well-educated. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Thank you for staying with us. Tune in again next week when I come back with a new topic on We the People.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. As for kindness to people, it plays an important role in strengthening social ties and spreading love and friendship among people. Islam has urged Muslims to cling to kindness to people. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, has said, "Continuous kindness is the best means with me." The most lovable things with the Imam, peace be upon him, was continuing kindness to people, for he wanted to plant love and affection in their hearts through it.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam has very many beautiful conversations and truly golden dialogues in the history of the Muslims. In his golden dialogues, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, talks about these beautiful words of wisdom and these great words of knowledge. Truly, when we listen to the words of Imam al-Baqir and we try to understand them and implement them in our lives, we realize truly that the epithet which was given to Imam al-Baqir, which is Baqir al-Ulum, meaning the splitter of sciences, the splitter, the expounder of knowledge, is truly a befitting epithet for him indeed. In one of his dialogues, we find that Imam al-Baqir is speaking to one of his companions. Perhaps it was Muhammad bin Muslim, or perhaps it was Zurara, or another companion of his. In response to a question, Imam al-Baqir starts to talk about how to treat people according to the rules of social conduct which are found in Islam. Imam al-Baqir specifically starts to talk about the rights which one Muslim has towards another Muslim, the rights which Islam has legislated for these relationships. Truly a beautiful religion, Islam, which takes into consideration all parties involved. Here Imam al-Baqir says, If you help your Muslim brother, he will help you. For your Muslim brother is from you, and you are from him. If your Muslim brother admonishes you, then do not leave him until his hate comes to an end. And if good befalls your brother, then thank Allah that he has blessed your brother. And yet, if a tribulation afflicts your brother, then help him. Very beautiful words, dear friends, indeed, in this conversation that Imam al-Baqir has with one of his special companions. We find words of advice and these pearls and gems of wisdom, truly which can change our own lives, change our societies, and even change the world in general. Allahu Akbar. We see here that we should help our brother, and in turn, our brother will help us. And remember that our brother, our Muslim brother, is from us and we are from them. And if by any chance they admonish you, do not be upset, do not take offense. Rather, stay there until their anger subsides and apologize. And more beautifully, if some sort of tribulation or disaster comes upon your brother, then help them out. Help them either financially or spiritually or morally or ethically. And finally, if some good comes upon your Muslim brother, do not become jealous of this. Do not become greedy of this. Do not envy the good which has befallen your Muslim brother. On the contrary, thank Allah, for it is Allah who has bestowed this blessing upon your brother who is of you. Very beautiful words, indeed, in this small and concise, yet incredibly profound conversation, this dialogue with Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam. We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
It's just not ilm and teaching, even on a practical level when it comes to akhlaq, how to be concerned for the members of the Shia community. You know, how to even deal with one another. These were the issues that Imam is basically, you know, giving us the example in his own life. When it comes to the, you know, the importance of the Imam as far as knowledge is concerned, one of the prominent scholars among Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah of the early days is a fellow by the name of Abdullah bin Umar, the son of the second Khalifa. He, in the Sunni books, is considered to be one of the prominent, you know, Tabi'een, if not Sahabi, I'm not sure whether he saw the Prophet. And his views are quoted very, you know, frequently in their books. The age and generation-wise, he is contemporary of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. So Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam was much younger, you know, almost two generations away. But even Abdullah bin Umar, who was alive at that time, sometimes when he would get struck, when people come and ask him questions, رَجُلًا إِنَّ رَجُلًا سَعَلَ عَبْدُلَّهِ بِنْ عُمَرًا مَسَائِلْ فَلَمْ يَقِفْ عَلَى جَوَابِهَا. A person came to Abdullah bin Umar, asked him some questions, he didn't know the answer. فَقَالَ لِلْرَجُلِ, he said to that person, اذهب الى ذلك الغلام. This is happening in the Masjid al-Nabi, where Imam was sitting in one corner with his companions. He points towards the Imam, and he was young, our Imam. He says, اذهب إلى ذلك الغلام. Go to that young man. فأسأله. Go and ask him the questions that you ask me. I don't have the answer. But not only go and ask him and get the answer. وعلمني بما يجيبك. Once you get the answers for him, come and share it with me. And so this person goes to the Imam, you know, asked him the question, got the answers. Then he went back to Abdullah bin Umar and informed him about the answers given by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. And that is where Abdullah bin Umar says, إِنَّهُمْ أَهْلُ بَيْتٍ مُفْحَمُونَ or مُفَحَّمُونَ, that indeed they are the Ahlul Bayt who have been given understanding and ilm and knowledge.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Today is the 13th of Farvardin, which has been named as Nature's Day in Iran. It is the last day of the Nowruz holidays. Stay tuned for a special feature on this occasion. old traditions of the Iranian people on this day is to go to the nature. People go to forests, parks, and mountains on this day to enjoy the beauties of spring on the concluding day of the Nowruz holidays. It is day for gathering together and sharing happy moments with one another. It symbolizes man's unity with the nature. This unity is one of the main elements of Iranian feast. If we survey the ancient Iranian traditions, we will find many feasts and customs that indicate unity and bond with each other. The global campaign against environment pollution has begun for less than two decades, while the Iranian nation has loved nature for several millennia. Iranians have always tried to preserve the nature and refrain from contaminating the nature and living environment. This has been strengthened by the Islamic teachings, as the leaders of this religion have put great emphasis on safeguarding the nature as the gift of God. According to the ancient Iranian traditions, the first 12 days of Nowruz were the symbol of 12,000 years of creation. Thus, on the 13th day, people go to the nature to gain new energy for better work and activity. There are many narrations on the 13th of Farvardin. The world-famous Iranian polymath, Abu Rayhan Biruni, was among the first people to study human customs. He can be called the pioneer of anthropology. Biruni says in his book, Al-Baghia, ancient Iranians used to call each day of the month with a specific name, and the 13th day of each month was called Tiruz. Tir is the name of a dear angel and a great, radiant, and auspicious star. Therefore, Tiruz means the 13th day of the month and a happy day for Iranians. Moreover, it has been mentioned in the Iranian myth that on this day and the fourth month of the year, that is, Tir, the borders of Iran and Turan, Central Asia and Transoxiana had been determined by the legendary Arash. Today, people get out of homes to enjoy themselves beside relatives and friends on the last day of Nowruz holidays, regardless of superstitions. People on this day go to the nature and try to entertain in forests, gardens, parks, and by riverbanks and mountain sites. Most people engage in gregarious games and try to prepare food together. Some families prepare swings by tying ropes to robots and old trees. These swings are mostly used by children and adolescents. As it was said, people make the food together, but women play a great role in making special foods for this day. Families take the remainder of Nowruz nuts to the nature to finish them. Some of the ethnicities in the west of the country make kufte for this day. Kufte is a special food that is made with round lumps of meat mixed with vegetables and grains and cooked in water. Rice and fish is also common on this day. However, one of the common foods on this day is ash, which is used for a series of Iranian soups that are made with a variety of vegetables and legumes. The special ash for 13th of Farvardin is usually prepared in the nature with different herbs that are gathered from the nature. Yet, ash reshte is one of the very popular foods on this day. In the south Khorasan province, in the east of Iran, and Yazd province, in the center of the country, women usually prepare a kind of bread on this day with flour, oil, and sesame seeds. In the north of the country, various kinds of halwa are prepared for this day. One of the very common customs on this day is to eat lettuce with a kind of tasty syrup called sekanjabin. Sekanjabin is composed of sugar, vinegar, and mint essence. Lettuce and sekanjabin are usually eaten in the afternoon of this day. So blossom family throw their green sprouts in rivers and running water, although this custom has no logical background. This year, like the previous one, people might not gather together as they used to before the coronavirus outbreak, but they try to enjoy the last day of Nowruz holidays even if they stay at home.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, two things cause destruction. If we consider the causes of increase in transgression, larcenies, theft, cheating, and plundering, we find that the following two factors are the root of all these events. Some people, having everything, commit offenses only for the fear of poverty and obsession for securing the future. And some others sacrifice their peace of mind and soul in order to acquire fanciful honors. Giving up these destructive traits allow man to enjoy inner peace and happiness. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "Two things destroy people, fear of poverty and seeking of fanciful honors." Brothers and sisters, when we look at our own lives, let's just introspect for a while, you know, and then look at people around us, look at the society we live in. Aren't these two factors playing a vital role in changing our worldview and changing our decision-making process? Do we not run after wealth even if we have enough and sufficient for ourselves? Why? Because we fear poverty. And then at the same time, we spend all that wealth just for those fanciful, artificial, and superficial honors. We want to be respected in the society. These things are prevalent issues of contemporary society, which is based on materialism. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we want to discuss this thing a bit more, where the fear of poverty is destroying our societies. Well, how do we treat this? What needs to be done in order for people to come out of this whirlpool, right? We're going to list out a few of the ideas just to get you thinking about the solutions to this potential issue of our societies. The first one is teaching people to believe truly that provisions come from Allah. Allah is the Radiq. Allah is the provider. Number two, seeking refuge with Allah from poverty. You know, poverty is not something that we should be seeking. Now, of course, we need to avoid it. But how do we avoid it? By running after the world? No. We have to seek refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and make sure that we don't get deceived by this evil of the society. Number three, encouragement to work and earn a living and to travel in the land to seek provision. Number four, making zakah obligatory on the wealth of the rich. This Islamic taxes, zakat and khums, you know, these are the Islamic taxes. If they're made obligatory, it solves a lot of the problems we see in the society. Number five, encouragement to give charity. Set up waqfs and sponsor orphans and widows. Number six, prohibition on riba, usury, gambling, and deceit in selling. These are the diseases of human society. Last but not the least for today's program is encouragement to help the needy and support the weak. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. In the limelight.
Since correction departments and immigration and customs enforcement contractors are unwilling to prevent the spread of the virus, prisoners and detainees have been taking action themselves to draw attention to the dangerous situation they find themselves in and to resist the system of incarceration that is killing them. Perilous's analysis found that people rose up inside federal and state prisons, jails, juvenile carceral facilities, and immigration detention centers in 39 states. Immigrant detention centers rebelled most frequently, with 45 separate events. 32 rebellions took place in private prisons, 25 of which had contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. A disproportionate response, as less than 9% of prisons in the United States are privately operated. Here we present you an article written by Ella Fassler, an independent writer and researcher based in Rhode Island, United States, under the heading, Report Finds Over 100 Rebellions in U.S. Jails and Prisons Over COVID Conditions. The article has been taken from the truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Ella Fassler's article. U.S. jails and prisons, already death traps, have been completely ravaged by COVID-19. Crowded quarters, a lack of personal protective equipment, inadequate medical care, and an aging population, and unsanitary conditions have contributed to an infection rate 5.5 times higher than the already ballooned average in the United States. In response, incarcerated people have shown strong solidarity, coming together to demand baseline safety measures and advocating for their release, only to be met with brutal repression and punishment. Perilous, a volunteer collective project that tracks information on all prison uprisings, riots, protests, strikes, and other unrest within the carceral facilities, described this activity as clearly one of the most massive waves of prison resistance in the past decade. Duncan Tarr, a researcher at Perilous, tells truthout.org, since correction departments and Immigration and Customs Enforcement contractors are unwilling to prevent the spread of the virus, prisoners and detainees have been taking action themselves to draw attention to the dangerous situation they find themselves in and to resist the system of incarceration that is killing them. Perilous's analysis found that people rose up inside federal and state prisons, jails, juvenile carceral facilities, and immigration detention centers in 39 states. Immigrant detention centers rebelled most frequently, with 45 separate events. 32 rebellions took place in private prisons, 25 of which had contracts with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. A disproportionate response, as less than 9% of prisons in the United States are privately operated. Louisiana, with a rich history of work stoppages and rebellions, was the state with the highest frequency of COVID-19-related prison rebellions. California and Washington State were the second and third most rebellious states, respectively. Common demands have included that prison guards wear face masks and that departments provide individuals with protective items like soap, face masks, and hand sanitizers. In early April, an estimated 120 to 180 detainees inside GEO Group's Adelanto ICE Processing Center in California went on hunger strike after two individuals exhibiting COVID-19 symptoms were sent to the hospital. Striker Marcos Duran told Perilous that the private prison guards weren't wearing face masks. Duran said detainees did not have access to soap or shampoo, were forced to eat alongside 50 to 60 other detainees, and slept in the same room as seven others. According to Desert Sun, as of 7th of October, nearly 20% of detainees at Adelanto Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility had contracted COVID-19. Beyond hunger strikes, Perilous documented 21 uprisings in American prisons, defined as collective acts of rebellion that exceed the usual scope of a protest through unpredictable or chaotic means. In Monroe, Washington, after 6 incarcerated people and 5 staff members were diagnosed with COVID-19, an estimated 100 to 200 incarcerated people staged a protest over inadequate protective measures and a downplaying of the virus in the recreation yard at Monroe Correctional Complex. Joshua Vermatt, an incarcerated person at the Monroe Correctional Complex, described his concerns in a letter to a friend, excerpts of which were published in Quo and NPR. He said the Department of Corrections was transferring uninfected incarcerated people into contaminated tiers. He wrote, "We've been safe until now, but because of their lack of foresight and proper planning, now they need rooms for more vulnerable inmates, and they want us to go into the hot zone to make room for them." He added, "They tried to bribe us with McDonald's food. Are you flipping kidding? If you would do anything, I ask you to tell this to the news and to the governor. This isn't right." Some prisoners refused orders to move. According to the Department of Corrections, their grievances were met with chemical weapons, rubber bullets, and sting balls. Demonstrators were ultimately forced to surrender. The next day, Vermatt said the resistance led to a change in tone from the Department of Corrections, but that the facility went on lockdown. He noted, "No one here wants violence. No one. But at the same time, you've got 400-plus prisoners who are now being backed into corners." 1 month later, a security guard at Monroe Correctional Facility died from COVID-19. Cook County Jail in Chicago, Illinois, a site with the largest outbreak of any location in the state of Illinois, rebelled on 6 separate occasions, including 1 uprising and several hunger strikes. On at least 1 occasion, some detainees attempted or threatened to attempt suicide. Over the course of April, the jail had released nearly a fourth of its population, decreasing it from 5,604 to 4,301. But despite early resistance, Cook County Jail's population has crept up again to nearly pre-pandemic levels. COVID-19 flare-ups behind bars have undoubtedly contributed to the United States' abysmal failure to control the virus. Despite urgent calls for action from public health scientists in The Lancet, the ACLU, and countless other organizations, Democratic and Republican politicians alike, from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to Alabama Governor Kay Ivey, have largely refused to reduce prison populations by any meaningful margin. In the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU's evaluation of state efforts to prevent COVID-19 deaths behind bars, Colorado, Kentucky, Maine, Michigan, Minnesota, Oregon, Tennessee, Vermont, and West Virginia received the best scores, all with a D. After sustained activism and a mounting death toll, on 4th of November, New Jersey released more than 2,000 incarcerated people who were already nearing the end of their sentences. In the face of negligence, Ivan Von Steik, an incarcerated person at the notoriously brutal San Quentin State Prison, filed a lawsuit in May against the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, charging deliberate indifference to the risk of substantial harm to inmates by failing to immediately reduce the prison population of San Quentin by releasing or transferring at least 50% of the population of the prison. After the court filing, San Quentin suffered an outbreak of at least 2,500 cases and at least 29 deaths. On 20th of October, the First District Court of Appeal in California ruled in Von Steik's favor, ordering the release or transfer of nearly 1,500 incarcerated individuals. The court wrote, if necessary to achieve this reduction, respondents are ordered to revise their expedited release programs to include inmates over the age of 60 who have served at least 25 years of their sentences and are eligible for parole, such as life prisoners eligible for parole and second or third strike prisoners, even if such prisoners are serving a sentence for a violent offense. However, incarcerated people and public health experts warn that transfers increase the spread of COVID-19. San Quentin's massive outbreak resulted from transfers. Christopher Blackwell, an incarcerated man at Monroe Correctional Facility, previously told Truth Out the best way to help keep prisoners from contracting the virus would be mass releases. He added, absent those, it is essential to cease transfers and provide incarcerated people with adequate supplies. As the United States enters its third wave of coronavirus infections, instead of mass release of prisoners, many departments' chosen preventative measures continue to be lockdowns, or confining people to their cells for 21 to 23 hours a day. It's estimated that 300,000 people incarcerated in state and federal prisons are in lockdown or solitary confinement conditions. Many incarcerated people have lost phone privileges and already scanned programming. According to Perilous Report, as budgets are slashed without complementary mass releases, healthcare services behind bars will continue to deteriorate. Prior to COVID-19, experts considered U.S. prisons to be ticking time bombs. Baseline volatile conditions remain that the virus is an accelerant. There is some hope that the virus will be better managed once next U.S. president takes power, although both Donald Trump and Joe Biden have not yet released a plan that puts people over profit. Duncan Tarr hopes that the Perilous Report will bring some attention to the struggle behind bars during this chaotic time. He said, as the national political crisis continues to play out over the next few months, it is important that some of the most vulnerable to COVID-19, those locked up by U.S. government, are not forgotten, and that their cries for help and freedom do not go unheard. He added, and a close look at the first few months of their resistance to the pandemic can shed some light on how we might move forward in preventing more unneeded deaths inside prison walls.
Iran Today.
Facebook shut down Press TV's page without prior warning. That was on Friday, March the 26th. It wasn't the first time, but this time it's permanent. Facebook gave no explanation for its action and no right of appeal to Iran. The American social media platform did say it had banned Press TV for failure to follow Facebook community standards.
but it didn't specify how Iran's professional English news network had violated its rules. Also, the so-called community standards are pretty shady and hard to follow. For a review of both media platforms and how it came to this, stay with me, Leila Faramanzi, on Iran Today. Social media sees no borders and requires no visa. It is a platform for citizens of the world to converse freely and exchange knowledge. But is it? It is, selectively. But those not selected may find themselves bound by the very social cyber platform of no boundaries. In our case, we were bound and thrown out of the ring. No fair competition here. No free flow of alternative information. Sounds hardly democratic. I asked for a comment on how an American institution might act this out of character so easily. Mr. Abedini is a media expert of position. He made a trip to Press TV studios to pitch in.
Such desperate reaction by a country that's the flag bearer of human rights, or so it likes to say. Then how can you even analyze such an action?
Previously, they all claimed that they defend alternative voices in cyberspace, but the United States has shown for at least over the past year that it does not adhere to the basic principles of liberal democracy. When former U.S. President Donald Trump is banned from Facebook, Twitter, and several other social media because the deep state made the decision, you can't expect they would allow other voices to be heard.
Here it is. The community standards we supposedly violated. Facebook says of its standards, we do not allow hate speech on Facebook because it creates an environment of intimidation and exclusion, and in some cases may promote real-world violence. Right, it does. Which is why homegrown terrorists and crazies should be removed from the platform. Except, Facebook doesn't seem to have a problem with them.
در مورد آزادی بیان هم همینطوره.
The same is true about freedom of expression. In the social networks, you see that they allow Iranians to learn how to make bombs, but they do not make the slightest move that is against the idea of liberal democracy. They simply block the account. They don't allow the photo of General Qasem Soleimani to be published. But there are dozens of pages belonging to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. How can you explain such a contradiction?
Where were the standards when white supremacists and thugs used Facebook to recruit crazies? Recruits that reportedly came to Kenosha with assault rifles after the shooting of unarmed Jacob Blake. There's no sign Facebook has any interest in removing domestic terrorists from its platform henceforth either. American social media platforms waste no time in silencing the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, but they serve as the playing field of anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes in the name of freedom of expression. Guess hate speech is free if it leads to spilling the right blood. The double standard is jaw-dropping. Mr. Momeniha comments. He's a media expert who gives us his time every so often.
Why now? Why has Facebook thrown Iran out of the ring now?
شبکه‌های بین‌المللی دنیا خب قاعدتاً از مخاطبینی که دارن بالاخره کسایی که
International satellite networks have audiences that need to pay fees to be able to use the contents of the channels. But you can see several Farsi-speaking channels out there that are working on huge budgets but won't demand payments from their audience. They produce a variety of programs for Iran and are looking for implementing U.S. policies on Iran and actively work to nullify what media outlets such as Press TV are doing.
The complete shutdown of the Facebook account of the Press TV network once again showed that the United States, despite its human rights gesture, does not give critics of America or Zionist occupation any rights in the media. But why do I say the United States? Well, stepping on the First Amendment's freedom of expression is a big feat for a social media company to undertake single-handedly. And looking at background,
In November 2019, the U.S. State Department called on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to suspend the accounts of Iranian government leaders. That is but one instance of such crackdowns, which have not stopped at officials' social